The following is Nadine Schaefer's talk, Design for Complexity, from the 2012 Information Architecture Summit. The 2012 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by User Interface Engineering and the UIE Virtual Seminar Program. Stay tuned after the podcast for a special offer from UIE.
My name is Nadine Schaefer, and I'm here today to talk to you about designing for complexity. So who in this room has been told by a stakeholder, just make it simple? Make it like Apple. Anyone? Anyone heard that before? You know, I've been told that so many times, and I'll be honest, it makes me a little irritated. I'm like, you know, not everything's simple. When people say that to me, I want to sketch out a big button, paint it in green, put done on it, hand it to them, send my invoice. Some things we're facing as designers, they're not easy. They're quite complicated, and that's what my talk is about today. I really love this image here. This is an artist in Italy who takes brainwave activity and converts it into digital images. And this is 1 second of brain activity. And the reason I show this slide is I think we forget as humans we're capable of incredible things. We build amazing things. We're incredibly complicated creatures. So my reason for giving this talk is I want to encourage all of you to embrace complexity, to give it a big hug, and I'm going to show you some techniques and some methodologies for doing that today. So who am I to talk to you about this subject? My name is Nadine Schaefer. I run a small UX agency in California with my partner Jason Wavenponer. I've been working in this field for a long time. I started in 1996. I've worked for Apple, I've worked for Oracle, a bunch of other companies, and a lot of the things I work on are quite hard. My specialty is enterprise applications. I work on data visualization. I work on financial services. I like the hard stuff, and I don't just mean the Sazeracs. I'm really drawn to this area, and I hope I can share some of my enjoyment for it with all of you today. What we're going to go over today is, first of all, I just want to talk about what complexity is truly necessary and why we can't just disregard it. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about the psychological underpinnings of why we have this impulse to fear the complex. After that, I want to talk a little bit about the dimensions of complexity, because you need to understand what you're dealing with. Then we'll look really quickly at some examples of what complex applications are. And finally, I want to present some tools and tricks and heuristics and solutions I use when dealing with complex applications. So let's take a look at this. This is your wonderful traffic cloverleaf overpass system. And you look at it and you're like, wow, that's a complicated mess of spaghetti. But have any of you ever been stuck in rush hour traffic in like Manhattan or London, right? Sometimes a little bit of complexity goes a long way. And so my point is sometimes these complex structures evolve for a reason, and they can be sources of innovation, they can be sources of great leaps in our ability to master our universe, and they can occasionally be quite beautiful. The other thing I want to point out is that humans love a path in life, and we often follow these natural paths from being novices to being masters, right? And my point is that maybe simple is the wrong word that we want to encourage. Maybe the proper approach and what we really should be working for is to help people become masters, help them become adepts at what they do. This here is a slide of the Space Shuttle Endeavor. And my point is that we've sent rockets to the moon. We've done the most incredible things as human beings, and we're capable of more. Complexity is something we should be celebrating and embracing in everything we do. Another reason I think complexity is really important is humans like to be in the flow. I don't know if any of you have ever tried to surf. I'm from Santa Cruz. I've tried. It's really hard, and I'm not very good at it. But I watch people do it all the time, and they got to start as little kids. And when they're out there, they're amazing. They're in the flow. And you know, some of us are in the flow when we're working with Photoshop or when we're working with our stakeholders or whatever it may be. Everyone has probably mastered something really, really complex and difficult. Now it doesn't seem so hard anymore, and it's even enjoyable because you enter into that flow state. So as we're designing software and applications, I want to encourage people to think about this as our end goal. Let's get people into the flow state instead of just saying, oh, let's just give them one button or make it super simple. Another point I really like to bring up is things that are often called simple really, really aren't, right? The iPhone is often shown and brought up as a paradigm of simplicity. I'm like, I don't think so. look at all those microchips. And the thing I think about sometimes, and I really kind of trip out on this, is think of the millions and millions of human hours that are invested in this tiny little sliver of technology. Think of all the effort that went into building the telecommunications infrastructure that supports it. It's insanely complicated. I only understand a tiny little slice of it, and yet it's amazing. So often when people are saying, oh, just make it simple, maybe the surface is, but underneath, all we're doing is abstracting away the complexity that is truly there. Another point that I always come back to is complexity is everywhere. If you look around you, this is a picture I took of a succulent sitting on a neighbor's front porch. It's just a plant, but it's a Fibonacci spiral. It's gorgeous. If you look anywhere in the world, you'll see, not just in technology, but in nature, this evolution from very simple organisms to quite complex ones. And from this complexity comes innovation and beauty. And so I exhort everyone, when you're just looking around, look at how beautiful complexity is everywhere around us. So that's my introduction. Now let's talk a little bit why we have this reaction to like fear the complex. And I think it's a very deep-seated human reaction we have, and it's understandable. There are good reasons for it. The simplest one we're all familiar with, is cognitive overload, right? This is something I'm sure many of you have encountered and studied and struggled with yourself. Our brains can only handle so many things at a time. And after a certain point, you get exhausted and you give up. And there's been a lot of research on this. And of course, this is not where we want to lead our users. Cognitive overload is just not the ideal state. So how do we move from cognitive overload to flow states? That's a lot of what I want to talk about today. Another reason I think we fear the complex is it's really easy to move from complexity to chaos. And this slide obviously is a tragic screenshot from the tsunami that hit Japan. And this was once an orderly, beautiful little Japanese village. And you know, in minutes, this is what it became. In our world, a really good analogy of that is any really complicated application or e-commerce site you've been on where the navigation is terrible and they disabled the back button, right? It's really, really easy to move from complicated, deep, gnarly subjects into the world of chaos. And we have really good reason to fear chaos. This is a very understandable impulse. I read a book over the holidays last year, and it really shaped and impacted my thinking about this subject. I really want to recommend it to anyone who hasn't read it. Dan Kahneman, I may be massacring his name, wrote a book called Thinking Fast and Slow, and he's a cognitive researcher, psychologist, won a lot of prizes, thought very deeply about these subjects. And his book is about how humans really think in two separate ways. There's fast thinking, what's 2 + 2, right? We can all come to a snap conclusion. We make snap judgments about people and things we see, and this is how we like walk down the stairs without falling on our faces. And we really enjoy fast thinking, and we're really, really good at it. But if I start to ask you more complex problems, such as what's 5,679 plus 384 times 98,252, you have to stop, right? You have to slow down. And we enter into a stress state, and no one enjoys that. And this man himself, he had a lot of really funny anecdotes about that. He said when he was walking in the morning in the Berkeley Hills, he'd start doing simple math exercises, 1 + 1, 2 + 3, and then he'd start doing more complicated ones and harder ones. And eventually he had to stop walking, because he couldn't actually walk and do the complicated math at the same time. Another thing that stood out from this book that I thought was just kind of fascinating and hilarious is when he'd run research subjects through similar tests, he had a camera on their pupils. And you can tell the stress reaction to a situation by how people's pupils dilate and expand. And he could tell the moment somebody was ready to just give up by just looking in their eyes. But the flip side of his research that really came home to me was that when we enter in a state of slow thinking, we don't like it, but we're more accurate. And the answers to the problems posed to us in this phase, in this mode, in this way of thinking, will be more thoughtful and will be more precise. And that really stood out to me because I'm often working with these really mission-critical enterprise applications, and you don't want people to jump to the quick answer or press the done button. You really want them to think the problem through. So, highly recommend the book. Really, really had a lot of impact in my thinking. Now let's talk a little bit about the dimensions of complexity. To be able to like battle with your enemy, you kind of have to know your enemy. And I think there are many, many, many different ways that applications can be super complex. So I want to go through them a little bit to give people an understanding of how you can define your problem set and then better able to solve for it. So these are the dimensions that I came up with. All of you would put different things in my little atom diagram, but here are some baselines for us to come back to. First, let's talk about humans and users, right? As user experience designers, we think about this a lot. There are many facets by which applications can be difficult and complex on the human scale. We can vary by language, by culture. Anyone who's had to localize across double byte languages knows this challenge very, very well. We can be different in just our cultural assumptions. We can be different in our skill level, our education, the amount of exposure we have to technology, our comfort level. These all play into how you design your software. And on the bottom, there's things that become very specific and begin to address some of these issues. Software is often broken down by role and by permissions. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And also just the amount of training and experience people have with a piece of software. The first day you open a complex software suite is very different from having used it for 10 years. The human dimension is particularly interesting to me, too, because it involves things beyond just software features. Humans are incredibly illogical, but in predictable ways. And there are the emotional aspects of complexity as well. There is desire to be part of a crowd, to belong, and also human compassion and a desire to connect with people, which we're beginning to see have a huge impact in software and all the social networks that we love so much. Another aspect of complexity that we're often dealing with, and something that this conference has come back to many, many times, is just volume and quantity. One particular angle of that that we've talked about in many of these sessions is just cross-channel and multiple devices and how to design for very, very different screen sizes. Another aspect of volume is just the amount of sheer data that we're dealing with a lot of times, and just the volume of users and the volume of objects. And this is just sometimes incredibly overwhelming in the applications that we're looking at. I mean, Amazon these days, I look at it and I'm like, wow, that's cluttered. Yet search works, and I can usually find what I'm looking for. And also just the number of tasks software allows us to use. I mean, let me show you a screenshot of something we're all very familiar with, Photoshop, right? Most of us in this room, how many people have used Photoshop? I've been using it for like 17 years now, and I think I only know about 25% of it still, you know? These applications become incredibly complicated because they're trying to solve for so many different use cases, so many different tasks, so many different things that you can do with them. The final aspect of complexity I want to look at is change over time. And this is an area I think there's still a huge amount of room for improvement and thought in software design. As I said before, the first time you open an application is very different from the second time, and using it again a year or 10 years from now. And I don't think we've yet mastered how software can evolve and change and adapt to usage over time. But I see a lot of attention paid to this now and a little bit more focus, and I think this is something we'll see more attention paid to in the future of our careers. Really enjoy sometimes looking back at very famous websites from 10 or 15 or 20 years ago to see how they've changed and if they even still exist today. Yahoo's a classic example. I remember when Yahoo first launched, and it was a hand-archived version of the web. Somebody went over there and like hand-coded all those links. And then you look at it today, we've got Miley Cyrus on the front, and who knows what it'll be 5 or 10 years from now, or if it'll even exist as a company. Change is so pervasive in our industry, yet I think it's an area that people often don't plan for or think about very much. So once you start to look at all the dimensions I've named, you can see that there are a lot of different ways to look at complexity, and when you're taking on a new software project, application project, I think it's really important to define which of these facets you're going to have to tackle and then create the right tools and solutions for it. I want to talk a little bit about some complex applications, just as food for thought, that I've worked with or think about a lot. One is logistics. I mean, it's so easy to click the buy button on Amazon. I do it a little too often. But when I really think what it took to get that pair of shoes or that book or that pot or whatever it is to my house, my mind boggles. However, some of our colleagues and consultants have worked on these applications that track logistics and moving pieces and bits across the world. It's fabulously complex. A friend of ours worked on an application called Navis, which actually tracks each one of these containers around the world, how much weight can be supported in every pad? How much weight can be supported on every boat? What boats they're on? I mean, it's incredibly complex stuff, and yet there's software that manages it quite efficiently. Usually, my Amazon packages make it to my house. Another one that we work with a lot is remote monitoring, and this is deep in the world of SysOps. How do you keep all those servers up? We often forget that there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of physical machines and virtual machines running the web, and the software to manage and monitor and keep secure these applications, these systems, is one of the most complex problem sets I've personally encountered. But even more complicated than that, and getting to my personal, I don't know if I'll call it my favorite project, but maybe one of the projects I've worked on that I'm the most proud of, is database management for Oracle. And this is the software that keeps your bank running, that keeps the stock exchange running. I don't think you can really dumb it down. It's pretty sophisticated, and yet working on this stuff gave me so many tips and techniques and tricks and understanding of what's useful in this space, which will be the last part of my talk today. Finally, this is something that I'm sure a lot more people are familiar with, just our accounting and analytics software. This is QuickBooks. Many of you have probably encountered it. There are many other packages. What was interesting to me is when Mint came out, who here's used Mint or likes Mint, right? Mint's awesome, right? I'm like, oh, they made it easy, and even better, they made it pretty. The designer in me was like just singing when I first saw Mint. But then we started a business, and we bought a house, and my single little banking account sprouted into 11 accounts, and Mint didn't work anymore. Because after a certain point, simple really isn't the answer. And we moved to QuickBooks, which Darrell's going to make awesome for us. And finally, an area that I also find really, really fascinating are makerly applications. And by that, I mean 3D modeling applications and engineering applications. This is a screenshot from Blender, which is an open source 3D application. For me, the abstraction of moving from the real world, supposedly 3D, to a screen, 2D, to model 3D is really quite challenging. Yet these applications are awesome, and they're getting better all the time. And when you think of all of the new tools out there for rapid prototyping and 3D printers, it's amazing the future that is being made possible through these applications. So finally, let's talk a little bit about how do we actually solve for complexity? And I'm going to slow down a little bit and talk a little bit in depth about the toolkit and the tool set I have come up with over the years to try to deal with the many clients and projects we work on. The first little item in my toolkit, and yes, it's supposed to be like a little Illustrator or Photoshop toolkit, is just prioritization. And you know, now through all of these different techniques, I'm coming back to tools and techniques and methodologies that as designers and information architects, you guys use all the time. And my point here is that this stuff isn't going to be new to you, and I really want to show how our toolkit translates into the hardest and most difficult spaces. So what I'm talking about here are simply weighting and ranking your use cases, doing a task analysis, talking to your stakeholders and then to your users to figure out what do they really need to do, what do they need to do in what order, what's most important, what's most important the very first time they open the application and then further on, and to start to really create a weighting on a page. Because when I'm looking at Enterprise Manager from Oracle, there's 10,000 tasks. There's so many different things you can do with this application. But most people are going to come in and do the same five things, or maybe they're going to come in and do setup the first day, and after that have the same five tasks. And you can really start to weight your application and the prominence of certain things on a page or in a navigation based on task analysis. Another really good and similar parallel technique here is just segmentation. And I have a dashboard from Mercedes for a car here, because cars do this pretty well usually. You have your main most important controls right there. How fast are you going? Are you breaking the speeding limit? Is there a red flashing light because you're out of oil? You know, important stuff's here. Then you have your heating and cooling stuff here. And you have your music control stuff here. Segmentation and grouping controls is something you see in your kitchen and you see in your bathroom and you see in so many common places, and it's a really useful tool to use for our software design as well. The next point I want to make about this is that if you look at how your organization is often structured and often look at how applications fall out of organizational structures, I think traditionally there's been a disjoint. And often you'll see applications that are so obviously grouped by business unit. And this is something I think we really have to fight against as designers. And this is where our user research and our user interviews and field research and whatever techniques you want to employ to actually see how people are going to use the software really comes in handy. Because a lot of times the right grouping, the right segmentation crosses business units and has to break down these traditional siloed models. So that's prioritization. Let's talk a little bit about patterns. I used a screenshot from Escher because I like Escher. But my point is that I think as humans we really love patterns. There's just something hardwired into us to do pattern recognition. I've been really enjoying and kind of fascinated by the carpet patterns in this hotel. I don't know if anyone else has, you know? And I just think there's something about patterns that we love and we look for and therefore make using software much, much easier. And a classic example of this is like search in the upper right-hand corner. And you know, there's some apps that put it in the left or bury it down below, but instinctually, we've now been trained over a very short period of time, just 10 or 15 years, to look for that search, I guess from your perspective, be over here, in the upper right-hand corner, right? And another classic pattern that might be a little tired, but people understand and know is the wizard. You've got step one. Oh, I'm on step one. And next I have to go to step two, and there's seven steps, and I know how many steps are there, and I know I'm going to go through them in a sequential order, and it's comforting to see these patterns. Another great pattern that we use all the time is just, you know, having the same button colored the same way with the same font and the same size everywhere on the page. And the more of these wayfaring clues that we can offer in our navigation that are consistent, I think the more comfort and the more sense of place people have from our applications. I was planning our trip here and making flight arrangements, and I was really kind of tickled to see that Kayak, Expedia, and Orbitz have decided this is the pattern to find a flight. And hey, it's great. They don't need to reinvent this wheel. It's a great pattern. We all know how to use it. It's very clear. And none of them, I'm sure they all did plenty of user testing, saw any reason to change it. It's a useful pattern. And I am never above looking to competitors and other websites and other applications to see what people's patterns are developing. Mobile's fairly new. Every time I'm asked to work on any sort of mobile or tablet device at this point, I go out and do so much research because these patterns are just emerging. I feel I know the patterns for the web pretty well at this point, but it's fascinating to me to see how patterns are emerging now on our new devices. One area where I think patterns are kind of getting the short shrift right now is on TV screens and film-based interfaces. Like if you try to move from Hulu to Xbox to Netflix to watch a show, everything's moving around all the time, and I don't know how to fix this. But my point is that there is no consistent pattern between these different TV-based media consumption applications at the point, and it's kind of a mess, and it drives me a little crazy, but I do think over time we'll see more patterns emerge in that space as well. So use patterns, look for patterns, research patterns, plagiarize madly from everyone else, because if it's familiar, people will have more success in using it. One of the things closest to my heart is data visualization. I love it. A picture really is worth a thousand words. And I personally cannot look at data tables. I mean, I know there are some people who love Excel, and I have a lot of respect for them, but you show me Excel, and my eyes start to glaze, and I think most people's reaction to screens of numbers and numbers and numbers is kind of the same. But this data that we're collecting and everything we do and is being collected for us, but that's a whole other topic, is rich and full of insight and full of trends and full of sometimes beauty and unexpected insight. This here is just Wordle. I ran it through our blog to see if we really were on topic with what I talk about in our blog. I was pretty happy to see that user and design came up pretty high. And this tells you more about what I do as a company quickly than going through and reading 30 or 40 blog articles. Whenever you can come up with a great data visualization that shows a trend, that shows a story, that keeps people from having to look at the data first, oh, please do, right? And the other thing I want to say about data visualization is use interesting data visualization. Use good data visualization. There are tons more tools being developed all the time. I'm kind of a processing dilettante myself. I'm not very good at it. But there are more and more ways to take data sets and convert them into beautiful and compelling graphics. And there are also new forms of data visualization coming out all the time. I really like stream graphs. Some of you may have seen Sankey diagrams. Sparklines are the tufty little mini charts. Bubble charts, network graphs. I have a question for you guys, by the way. I'm thinking of doing another talk or blog post just a little bit about these new data visualization techniques. Is that interesting to people in the room? Thank you. Appreciate that. Because all the time I see people who are much better at this than I am coming up with radically new, interesting, dynamic, and innovative ways to present data. So this is another way to give people a big picture view and something they can understand, something they can relate to, without getting into the complexity at the very beginning. Now let's talk about roles. I talked about this a little bit in my little atom diagram. Let's talk about it some more. I found this picture up on Wikipedia, and I just love it. In the 18th century, you actually could tell what somebody did by wearing a hat. How cool is that, right? Now we can't. But, you know, we can do our user research, and we can talk to our users, and we can find out that people use software very, very differently. To go back to Photoshop, something that I think is pretty fascinating is we started out with Photoshop, right? Now we have Lightroom for hardcore photographers. We have Fireworks for web developers. We still have Lightroom, and Adobe keeps inventing new tools all the time because they realize that different roles need different tool sets or different weighting of tool sets. And this is something I find so useful in these complicated applications. It really, honestly, is the only way we could deal with Enterprise Manager. When I was working at Oracle, we just had too much complexity. So we went through and did some very careful analysis. We did a lot of user research. And we created personas based on roles to figure out what each type of user really needed. And then we had a very different interface layout depending on role. So this is something I really, really encourage people to think about and try to integrate in their applications when they can, because different people may need to use your software very, very different ways. And there's no need to reveal the incredible complexity of a set of tools no one's ever going to use, or at least not within that role. So this can be really, really powerful. And beyond just like permissions-based roles, something that I think is coming up as a really interesting topic more and more too is behavioral roles. And this really plays in when we're looking at all of our social software as well. I didn't create this chart, but I think it's really a pretty good summation of how different we are on the internet and with our social networks. I personally generally start out as a critic. Oh, I'll never use that. And then I become a spectator. And then I become a joiner. And then I'm an active, right? But we move through these different behavioral roles when we use social tools. And some people really gravitate to different parts of this wheel, and I think our software can really reflect that as well. This goes back, this point is learn and adapt to your users. And this goes back to the idea of change over time. We change in our usage of software, and our software changes all the time as well. People are constantly releasing new features. People are constantly adding new abilities to the applications we use. And this software needs to change and adapt based on the user as well. So if you have someone who is always using A, B, and C in an application and never D through M, after a while you can learn that behavior and never show them D through M. Or, you know, and a lot of, so many applications do this. I was playing with Twitter this morning. I was very happy to see that the hashtags I had been using all morning came up first in my little search. This is adaptive software, and I think the more we do this, the more attached people become to software. It's not only that it becomes more useful, it becomes more personal, and it becomes more intimate, because it begins to reflect your personal usage of the tool. So you know, just as our little finches adapted, as Darwin tells us, over time to where they lived and what food was available, I think it's a really interesting aspect to consider. How can software adapt to different people's behavior as they use it over a week, over a month, over a year? And I think these personalized experiences, so that your software really becomes your own little work table or work desk or kitchen space or whatever it may be, I think really endears software to people as well as making it so much more useful. Finally, well, not finally, but close to finally, the other point I want to make, another point I want to make is sometimes, you know, you've just got to embrace it and say, you know, we're going to expose the complexity. This is a cockpit of a Boeing 747. I think somebody else in another presentation used a similar cockpit analogy, which is a little gratifying to me. But my point in here is that when someone's flying a plane, I just do not want an up and down button. I don't want a little trackpad, okay? I want them to have the controls they need. And there's a lot of mission-critical software where really you just have to expose a lot of the complexity and people need it. Now, you can train them to use it. You can ease them into it. There are a lot of great techniques to get people up to speed. But sometimes, don't fight it. Just show it. This slide is from something maybe many of you have seen before. It's Eames Power of 10, and it's all about zooming in and out. The first slide, of course, is of the whole solar system. We zoom in on the Earth. We zoom in on a human on Earth. And finally, we go down to the molecular level. And this power of zooming in and out reframes what we're looking at. In software, we can do the exact same thing. And the obvious example is a map, right? We're always zooming in and out of Google Maps or Google Earth, and it's really fun and it's really neat. But you can do it on a more abstracted level as well. And anytime you click the little plus or minus sign on a Microsoft app and you expand things, that's exactly what you're doing. And search is another form of expanding and collapsing. And oftentimes, just links are. You're going from the first page and you're drilling down. And there's many ways to zoom in and out of data, objects, media. It's a really powerful tool. And again, you can link this into your data visualization. You start out with the big picture view, and then people can click on a specific date, a specific data object, a specific trend. So always try to keep in mind what level of data exposure does the user need at this particular moment, and give them abilities to move in and move out of what they're looking at. Something that I find particularly fascinating myself these days is, of course, social and emotional design and how we can leverage the way our minds work and the way that we're social creatures to make our software and applications better. Social networks, I mean, we're all on Facebook and Twitter, so I don't need to talk to you about that. But I think what's more interesting is the motivational factors behind why we are so attracted to these tools and why we find them so compelling. You'll see at the bottom, I am a member of DAC Exchange. Jason makes fun of me. I think I won Stack Exchange last year because they're starting to send me free stuff. And yeah, they totally got me hooked. It's like, oh, they created a platform, Core is exactly the same, where smart people can show off how smart they are and get little gold stars. And I fell for it, 100%. I like spent a month when I was on them way too much. I was like, oh, I got to step back. But it really showed me how compelling these social aspects of recognition from your peer group and competition really can be. And I think that this is really interesting and appropriate, valuable to complex software because you can use these motivational factors of human emotion to get people over the hump of complex software. If you give them a social way to share, to bond, and often to compete with their peers, they'll be more incented to deal with really, really complicated tasks. And finally, the last little tool in my toolkit is to remember that oftentimes the best UI is no UI. And if you can think of ways to work around having a physical interface, maybe it's a text message, maybe it's an email, maybe it's a phone call, maybe it's a script running on the back end. Anytime you can reduce complexity by just not putting it on the screen, please, please do. And this is also an exhortation to talk a little bit more with your stakeholders, your product managers, and your engineering team to brainstorm about this. How can we remove complexity from the screen, from the application, and think of other ways to deal with UI? So that's my little toolkit for you guys. I actually finished a little bit early. The slideshare is already up. Please feel free to go grab it. I'm open for questions, and I've also promised you all posters, but I'm a little embarrassed to say I didn't print enough. Everyone grab a poster that wants one and can, but when you're done, if you run out, just grab one of my cards, send me your mailing address, and I will put one in the mail to you. Thank you all for taking the time to come and listen to me. I also want to thank all of the volunteers and organizers for this awesome event. Just give them a round of applause, please. All right, any questions?
Great talk. I really enjoyed it. We do a lot of app design as well as systems management. I was wondering, have you found any way to integrate these social aspects into a systems management tool successfully?
Tell me a little bit more of what you mean by systems management.
Well, like your the Oracle project that you have. We just do lots of complex web applications.
Right,
and
right.
Some of them lend themselves to maybe collaboration and communication with people using the same tools.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, profile completeness or badges or any of these gamification techniques don't really
fly so much.
Fly.
Yeah.
Have you found any?
Yeah. At Oracle, where we worked with that a lot was my Oracle support, which is the support system for Oracle. And any of you who have been subjected to Oracle in the past, my apologies. But support is a huge part of what they offer because no one can figure out how to use Oracle out of the box, so they use support. And we started to integrate a lot of these social aspects, mostly around peer-to-peer support. So people could ask a question in a forum, and before the support they paid for had time to answer them, a lot of times just other customers would jump in, and again, it's this like, we love to show off how smart we are. People would start answering each other's questions. And that worked really, really well. And there was a lot of concern about proprietary information. I mean, these are banks and financial institutions. But nonetheless, people were really good at self-editing their content, so they didn't say anything that was revealing of their organization, yet were able to help people with, you know, really you need to download this patch, or here's a bug fix, or here's a workaround, or this is the module you're missing. And that worked really well for us.
So maybe if we just asked our clients to maybe use something like Get Satisfaction to help build that support community,
exactly.
You know, they could use that out of the box.
Right, and there's some great out of the box tools. Great. Anyone else? You're an easy crowd. All right, well, if anyone has any questions for me to follow up afterwards, please feel free to contact me anytime. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the 2012 IA Summit. The IA Summit podcasts are sponsored by the UIE Virtual Seminar Program with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. For free access to a virtual seminar, visit uie.com/IAS12. And you can find the rest of the IA Summit podcasts at library.iasummit.org.